You need this open anymore?
I'm okay.
All right. I think I'm in the right place, 16. Okay. Since it's been a week, let's refresh our memory about the whole process and then the parts of it. What is the overall process we're studying?
The complete observation of glucose.
Correct. That's the overall start to finish process. And there's two parts to that, right? What is the first part?
Glycolysis.
Yes. And that has 10 steps just by itself, right? What's the second part? The part that we're in right now.
Cellular respiration.
Right. Which occurs in the mitochondrion, right? In eukaryotes, that is. Well, cellular respiration is part two of the overall process, but cellular respiration itself has three parts. What's the first part of cellular respiration? I don't look at your notes. Just tell me. You don't get to use any notes on the test. Anyone know? Okay, then you're not prepared. This test is usually the hardest. It's the make or break one that will determine whether you have a mathematical chance of passing or not in a lot of cases. So you cannot wait until the end. You have to study this as I deliver it each night. Study a little bit. The first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The second part is the citric acid cycle. And that's where we left off. And that's what we're looking at right here in more detail than we did before. The third part is oxidative phosphorylation. So it's the third part of the second part of the overall process. And an oxidative phosphorylation can then be broken down into two parts, which are electron transport and chemiosmosis. So we haven't gotten to those things yet, but that's where we're headed. All right, so now we are in the second part of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle. That's shown here in more detail than we looked at it before. You didn't see all these intermediates before, and I don't expect you to memorize all the intermediates in this course. But we can see that it's a pathway, like any pathway. It's a series of reactions, but what makes it a cycle is that the end of the pathway feeds into the beginning again. So you have more or less a start-finish line at the top here. And keep in mind what the overall accomplishment of the citric acid cycle is, which I mentioned last time. The citric acid cycle completes the oxidation of what's left of the fuel. You started out with glucose, right? It's only glucose right at the beginning. Glycolysis turns that into two pyruvates. It gets a little bit of energy out of it. And in the process, partially oxidizes the fuel to get some energy in the form of ATP made by substrate-level phosphorylation. But it also, some of the energy extracted from the glucose in glycolysis gets put into the form of reduced coenzymes, NADH and H+. Right? Then you have the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, part one of cellular respiration. That breaks the fuel down a little bit more because you go from a 3-carbon pyruvate to a 2-carbon acetyl that gets picked up by coenzyme A and delivered to the citric acid cycle. So at this point, fuel-wise, all you have left are two 2-carbon acetyls. Still valuable because we haven't completely dehydrogenated the carbons and we haven't completely dismantled the skeletons. That's how we maximize the extraction of fuel from fuels, of energy from fuels. By dehydrogenating it, picking all the hydrogens off, and those hydrogens are sources of electrons and protons that get carried by coenzymes to the final part that we haven't gotten to yet. That'll be the big payoff. So part of it is dehydrogenation of the fuels, but also, just like carbon-hydrogen bonds are valuable for energy, so are carbon-carbon bonds. So the rest of it is dismantling the carbon skeleton, which is originally a six-carbon skeleton when we start with glucose, into six individual one-carbon CO2s, which you should think of as completely spent fuel. Carbon dioxide doesn't have any more usable energy in it for the cells. And so that's what I mean when I call the overall process the complete oxidation of glucose. We've extracted as much as we can get out of it if we go all the way to carbon dioxide. Well, we haven't gotten all the way to carbon dioxide until or when we get to the beginning of the citric acid cycle, because for that one glucose that we started with, we have two carbon acetyls, each of which has hydrogen that can be picked off, and each of which is two carbons in the skeleton that can be dismantled. That's what the citric acid cycle does. It completes the oxidation of the fuel. And we talked about this last time, but here we can see the details as far as the intermediates are concerned. At the end of the cycle, or right before the start-finish line, is this oxaloacetate compound. And notice, when you look at the structural formula, that it's a four-carbon compound. Coenzyme A is currently carrying, as a passenger, acetyl from part one of cellular respiration, which is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, right? This is what's left of pyruvate after you take the CO2 off of it. That's the decarboxylation part. So you have a two-carbon compound that is going to be delivered to a four-carbon compound, oxaloacetate, to form a six-carbon compound called citrate, or citric acid, which is why another name for the Krebs cycle is the citric acid cycle. Think about what's trying to be accomplished, though. You're trying to completely dismantle the carbon skeleton, right? And really what you're doing is building up an even bigger carbon skeleton to begin with by adding a 2-carbon acetyl to a 4-carbon oxaloacetate. The reason that makes sense, though, is because chemically that will allow this 6-carbon citrate to be stepwise decarboxylated. And so notice there's two places here where CO2 is being stripped off. Those CO2s represent the two carbons that are in the acetyl that enters the cycle. So if you have two more CO2s coming off, and you'll have two more coming off for the other acetyl that you have from the original glucose, everything has to be multiplied by two, remember, then you have 6 carbon dioxides total. 4 from the citric acid cycle, because you multiply these by 2 since it happens twice, and 2 from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, since you have 2 pyruvates that get decarboxylated. 4 plus 2 is 6. So fuel-wise, there is nothing left. No usable fuel is left by the time you're done with the citric acid cycle. But even though the citric acid cycle does produce some ATP, and it's produced the same way as it is in glycolysis, namely by substrate-level phosphorylation, you still don't have all that much ATP that's been produced, which is the goal, to produce ATP, even though you have no fuel left over. And that's why the citric acid cycle is not the end of the overall process, even though it's the end of the fuel. In addition to producing some ATP, the citric acid cycle also extracts energy and stores it temporarily in the form of even more reduced coenzymes. Notice that there's 3 different places here where NADH and H+ are produced. NAD plus gets reduced into NADH and H+. That's valuable stuff. Even more valuable than ATP, because one NADH is carrying enough energy to eventually produce multiple ATPs. All right? And also, an FADH2 is produced. That's what we were talking about at the end of last lecture. It's just a different version of a coenzyme, but it's doing the same thing, extracting hydrogens and carrying them. So at this moment, no more fuels left. We have a little bit of ATP produced from glycolysis by substrate level phosphorylation. We didn't produce any ATP in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. We did produce a little bit of ATP in the citric acid cycle. That ATP is valuable, that's the goal, and it's no different from any other ATP. It doesn't have to be further processed, but it's just not all that much compared to how much energy there is in the fuel. And so at this point, other than this ATP that we've already produced and the heat that we've lost and can't do anything about, that's wasted, the usable energy that is left, since there is no more fuel, is in the form of a bunch of NADHs and H+, and some FADH2, reduced coenzymes, in other words, which get produced in all three places up to this point. Well, the NADH does. Glycolysis produces NADH and H+. It reduces NAD+. The oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate produces NADH. The citric acid cycle produces NADH. And the citric acid cycle also produces FADH2. All of those taxis are full. That's where the energy is that hasn't already been made into ATP. And so there's no more fuel left, but since the goal is to produce ATP, there is more to the process, and namely it involves these taxis delivering these high energy electrons, these particles they're carrying as passengers, to the final part of cellular respiration so that the energy can be put into creating a lot more ATP for the final payoff. That's what oxidative phosphorylation is all about. This is slide 17, and this is kind of two figures in one. For one thing, it's a graph, notice, has a y-axis of free energy, so G. Since it's a graph, the higher on this graph, the higher the free energy value. Notice it goes diagonally down with these blue blobs. But the other reason, the other part of this figure is that it's also kind of an anatomical diagram in a sense, only in cartoon form, because these blue blobs represent proteins, protein complexes, and specifically membrane-bound protein complexes. So the membrane isn't shown here, but they are part of a membrane. And together, these protein complexes form what is called an electron transport chain. Now, there are millions of electron transport chains that are identical. This is just one copy of them. I'm saying this because a lot of books write it, they'll say the electron transport chain, like there's one. Well, there's millions of copies of them. This is just one copy, though. But overall, an electron transport chain consists of four major protein complexes that you see numbered here with Roman numerals. 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's IV. I don't know why it came out that way. But anyway, they are embedded in a membrane. What membrane are we talking about? What membrane do you think they're embedded in? Where is all this occurring that we've been talking about? Yes, everything is in the cell, including glycolysis. But after glycolysis is done, well, where does glycolysis occur?
In the cytosome?
In the cytosol. The liquid component of the cytoplasm. So outside of the organelles, but inside the cell. That's where you get your two pyruvates at the end of glycolysis. But where does cellular respiration occur? In a mitochondrion. And remember that the mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. There's two membranes, right, called outer membrane and inner membrane. And therefore, there's two separate compartments in the mitochondrion. The compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane is called the matrix, the mitochondrial matrix. And the compartment that's between the two membranes is called the intermembrane space. Those are both inside the mitochondrion, but they're separate chambers, basically. And what separates the two compartments is the inner membrane itself. And that inner membrane, inner mitochondrial membrane, is where you find the electron transport chains. This is just one of them. All right, so the membrane isn't shown here. A different picture will show you the membrane. That's where they are, though, physically. The reason that this is going down diagonally is because what's happening here is a process called electron transport, which is why the chain is called an electron transport chain. It accomplishes electron transport. And the transport of electrons from one member of the chain to the next is such that electrons go to a slightly lower energy level each time they go from one member to the next. That's why you're going down in G value, one step at a time. That's why it's diagonally downward, yeah. From which point? Yeah, well, let me phrase it a different way. An electron transport chain, this group of protein complexes, are acting, this is a little bit of an old-fashioned analogy, they're acting like a bucket brigade. Do you know what I mean by a bucket brigade, anyone? In case you don't, if you live out in the middle of nowhere, the only source of water is a well on your farm, let's say. The barn's on fire. A bucket brigade is a bunch of neighbors that get together, line up, one of them by the well where the water is, and then all of the other ones beside them. And instead of people picking up a bucket and running over to the fire, they'll pick up a bucket, pass that bucket to the next person, and so on down the line until the person right next to the fire dumps it on. And then they'll receive another bucket as it's coming down the line and so on. That's a bucket brigade. That's kind of what's happening with electron transport. So the electron transport occurs because the first member of the chain receives electrons, passes them to the next member, and so on. And when it happens, and this is what I think you're asking me to repeat, when electrons go from one member of the chain to the next, they actually lose a little bit of energy. That's why they're going down in G value, which is the y-axis. All right. Now, since it's electrons that are being transferred along the electron transport chains, what is it chemically that's happening to the members of these chains? You know, for electron transport to happen, the first member, this complex one, has to receive electrons in order to pass it on to the next. But if it receives electrons, what's happening to it? Yeah, but specifically, what would you describe that as if it's receiving electrons? Yes, the electrons are carrying a negative charge, but what do you call the receiving of electrons? What do you say? Right. Reduction is the gain of electrons. So the complex 1 is going to be reduced if it receives electrons, right? But it's not going to stay reduced because it's going to hand those off to the next member of the chain, becoming reoxidized itself, but then reducing the second member, and so on. So electron transport is really just a series of redox reactions, because electrons get transferred from one member to the next. And every time that happens, the electrons are getting closer to an atomic nucleus than they were before, and therefore their G value goes down a little bit. Well, remember that a couple times already we've compared organisms to multi-step hydroelectric plants. because we don't release all of our energy of fuels in one shot. We do it a little bit at a time. This is a perfect example of that, the electron transport chains. Okay, now, I said that complex 1, which is the first one in line in any given chain, receives electrons. But what does it receive electrons from? The coenzymes that have picked them up from the fuel at those various places along the way that we've already talked about. Right? When I said a little bit ago that glycolysis produces some reduced coenzymes, that's because NAD plus picks up electrons and protons in the form of the hydrogens stripped from the fuel in glycolysis. That's where it picks up the passengers. Some NAD plus picks up additional passengers in part 1 of cellular respiration, oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Some more NAD plus picks up even more passengers in the citric acid cycle, and FAD picks up passengers also from the citric acid cycle. So you have all these full taxis carrying electrons and protons, and the electrons get dumped off. The destination, in other words, of these taxis is the electron transport chains. Notice, though, that NADH is able to drop its electrons off directly at complex 1. FADH2 can't do that. It has to drop it off at complex 2, which is means it starts off at a little bit lower energy. So in terms of the overall payment, or payoff that we're going to look at next, FADH2 isn't quite as valuable in terms of how many ATPs it can eventually produce. But it's still a lot, still very valuable. All right, now these are the electrons, which are just really part of the passengers, right? Because the coenzymes are carrying electrons and protons. The protons get dropped off as well, but they don't get passed from member to member of the chain. And that's why it's not electron and proton transport chains. It's the electron transport chain. Okay, so the protons get dropped off into solution. That empties the taxis, right? Because when NADH drops its electrons and protons off, it turns it back into NAD plus. And just like an empty taxi in a real city, it's able to now pick up more passengers. So it can drive back to the earlier processes and get more. And then drive them back here and continue this process. Now, that's one function of the electron transport chains, to actually transport the electrons. The protein complexes that make up the chains, though, well, 3 of the 4, also have a second function. And the 3 of the 4 that have this second function are the big ones here, 1, 3, and 4. That second function of these 3 major complexes is to operate as pumps. And specifically, proton pumps. Now keep in mind, these things are embedded in a membrane, right? And we've already talked about pumps that operate as part of a membrane, pumping something through the membrane, right? In fact, we've already talked about proton pumps. That was one of the examples we used. What is a proton, also known as?
Hydrogen
ion, yes. H plus, proton, hydrogen ion all mean the same thing. So that's what these 3 big complexes, 1, 3, and 4, Roman numerals, are also doing. They're pumping protons from one side of the inner mitochondrial membrane to the other side. And specifically, they're taking the protons from the matrix, pumping them through the inner mitochondrial membrane to the intermembrane space. Now, what do you know about pumps? If a transport protein is a pump, What does that tell you?
Fires energy.
Right. It means that it operates by active transport. That's how it's able to move things against their gradient in the opposite direction that they would like to move in. So pumps require energy. What was the source of energy for the proton pump we already looked at? When I was originally talking about primary and secondary active transport. What powered the proton pump in the plant? ATP, yes. Often pumps are powered by ATP because it's versatile. ATP can be used for so many things. That's why we're trying to make it. But think about using ATP to power these pumps. It would be ridiculous, right? Because the whole idea of this process is to produce ATP, not to spend it. Well, you can't get around the fact that pumping requires an external source of energy. But here, the source of energy is not ATP. What is the source of energy? It's working against the gradient, so that's why it requires energy. The gradient of hydrogen ions is in the other direction. Hydrogen ions want to come back through the membrane into the matrix. It's pumping them against that.
I mean, like in the secondary, now I'd use something else to use that gradient.
It's actually not secondary because there isn't some other pump that's producing a gradient to do that. It's all here. The source of energy to power these pumps is the release of free energy from the electrons as they get passed along the chains. It goes down in energy a little bit at a time, right? Well, that energy, some of it's lost as heat, but some of that energy goes into allowing these three complexes to operate as proton pumps. Okay, so both passengers are useful. The electrons provide the energy to pump the protons, and the protons are then useful because once you have that gradient created, keep in mind that a gradient is a form of stored energy. Right? Now, in the previous part, which was the citric acid cycle, we had already spent all the fuel, right? There's no more fuel left. We made only a little bit of ATP. And all of the usable energy that remained from what was originally in glucose was in the form of reduced coenzymes. Well, now that these reduced coenzymes have dumped their electrons and protons off, they're no longer carrying that energy. And once the electrons trickle down through the chain, they lose energy. So now you don't have anything left in terms of energetic electrons from the fuel. But it's still worth doing this, because where is the energy now? Because you still haven't made ATP, which is the ultimate goal. Therefore, you have to have energy that you've stored somewhere so that you can make that ATP. Where is the energy at this point? Energy that hasn't already been put into the form of ATP.
Maybe just in like the electrons it took from the coenzymes?
Well, they are energetic here at the beginning, but once they trickle down, they've lost their energy. That's what I was just referring to. So they've lost their energy. The electrons are not going to be good anymore. Where is the source of energy? Where has the energy been stored? In where? Well, not the pumps themselves, but what the pumps do. When a pump operates, it produces a gradient, right? So these pumps, by pumping protons, stockpiling them on one side of the membrane, have created a gradient. And a gradient is the stored form of energy. So at this point, the energy that's still usable and hasn't been put into ATP and hasn't been wasted as heat is in the form of a proton gradient. That proton gradient is storing the energy that was in glucose originally. That's why the electron transport chains operate, to transform the energy in the form of reduced coenzymes into the form of a proton gradient, which can there a gradient, if you set things up properly, a gradient can do some work for you. As we'll see, that final bit of work that the gradient's going to operate for is to produce a lot more ATP. So electron transport is just one of the two processes that make up part three of cellular respiration. Part three is called oxidative phosphorylation. Electron transport is just part one of oxidative phosphorylation. And at this point, the energy is in the form of the proton gradient. Storing the energy in the form of a proton gradient. Okay, now, it's not hard to find someone just randomly on the street who knows that we require oxygen. But I have asked this question to a lot of students in biology, and very few can answer it. Why do we need oxygen? What does oxygen do for us? It actually is, other than the fact that we need it for the reason I'm trying to get you to come up with, it actually can damage a lot of things because it's so reactive. That's why we have antioxidants to protect us. But there's... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You're carbon out of our system?
Not really, no. It is true that oxygen gets, at the lungs, traded for carbon dioxide because we want to get rid of that carbon dioxide, which is completely spent fuel. And we trade it because we're bringing in oxygen from the air since we need the oxygen. But what does the oxygen actually do? No. I mean, it's involved in the process, yes, but it not at all directly. Yeah.
Maybe in like the creation of water in order to do like combustion.
Well, it will create water, but not because water needs to be created. It just happens to form water. Think about an electron transport chain, just like a bucket brigade. You know, you can operate it as long as every member of the chain is able to receive more electrons, right? So if you deliver electrons to an empty transport chain, no problem, the electrons will go to the end. But if that last member hangs on to them, then the next electrons will only go to the next to the last member. And eventually the whole chain will fill up, right? And once the chain is filled up, just like a person can't get any more buckets if he's currently carrying a bucket, there's no more electron transport that can happen. In other words, the last member of an electron transport chain has to get rid of its electrons in order to accept more and allow for electron transport to continue. Is this all making sense? That's exactly what oxygen does for us. That's why we have to breathe oxygen. Because oxygen, with its very high electronegativity, will gladly take the electrons from the last member of the chain, which is what's happening right here. In fact, it doesn't take just the electrons, it takes protons as well. And when you add an electron and a proton together, you have a hydrogen atom. So oxygen is taking hydrogens, which came from the food that we ate, because remember, the electrons and protons were in the form of hydrogens that are part of glucose originally. Those hydrogens get put onto the oxygen that we breathe to produce water. And that allows, you know, this is like allowing an outlet so that you can continue to put more in at the first end. If you don't, if it fills up, there's no more release of energy, and therefore no more pumping, and therefore no more creation of a proton gradient. So the whole thing shuts down without oxygen. Okay, let's go to 18. Now we're looking at the overall last part, but it's also the second part of chemiosmosis, which is the third part of cellular respiration. Second part of oxidative phosphorylation, which is the third part of cellular respiration. And this second part of oxidative phosphorylation is called chemiosmosis, which I guess isn't written there. So let me write that. And here we see a little bit of membrane. Now, the overall cell would be much bigger than this building, because in that cell there's many different kinds of organelles, including several different mitochondria. We're just inside one mitochondrion, and we're looking at just a tiny piece of the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Okay, so we're really close up. These are phospholipids. But this is the inner mitochondrial membrane. So it separates the mitochondrial matrix, which is the yellowish part, from the intermembrane space. Okay? The electron transport chains that I just talked about pumped protons, using the energy released by the electrons, pumped protons through this same membrane from the matrix to the intermembrane space. That creates a gradient where there's a high concentration of protons in the intermembrane space, a low concentration in the matrix. Therefore, if you are one of those protons, because of that gradient, you want to go back through the membrane into the matrix, down your gradient. Is that clear? Remember, I said that a gradient is the tendency for diffusion to occur. But you also have to have a way to get there. And protons, even though they're tiny, are fully charged. So even though they'd like to go right through the membrane to get back to the matrix, they can't get through the phospholipid bilayer because they don't want to be around those nonpolar tails. Therefore, they're going to have to find the only place on the inner mitochondrial membrane, or many copies of it, but this is just one, only places that they can get back through the membrane into the matrix, down their gradient, is through this little molecular machine, which is made up of protein complexes, that this purple and blue thing together is called an ATP synthase. And as the name implies, with the ASE ending, ATP synthase functions as an enzyme. The reason it's called synthase is because synthesis means bringing together two things. The two things that get synthesized, brought together, are ADP and inorganic phosphate. In other words, ADP gets phosphorylated by sticking another phosphate onto ADP to create ATP. All right? Now, I said this is a molecular machine because there's moving parts to it. Notice that there is a rotor and a stator, the same exact words that you find for motors. The rotor is the part of the motor that turns. The stator, meaning static or not moving, is the part that stays stationary. All of this is partially embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. All right. The rotor, we'll talk about it spinning in a minute, but the rotor has at one end of it, the end that's in, that's immersed in the mitochondrial matrix fluid, has what are called catalytic knobs. Catalytic means that they're used as enzymes. They're a catalyst. So each individual knob is its own enzyme, basically. There's just many copies of it, one per knob. And when it's able to act as a catalyst, as an enzyme, it does this phosphorylation of ADP that I was talking about, transforming them into ATP. That's the goal, right? To produce ATP. Well, this is not substrate-level phosphorylation like it was when we produced ATP in the earlier steps, because it's not a substrate that's carrying phosphate originally and then just hands it off. Instead, it's inorganic phosphate being stuck directly onto ADP to produce ATP. And that's oxidative phosphorylation rather than substrate-level phosphorylation. The ATP that's produced is indistinguishable, but this is a different way of making it. Well, importantly, these catalytic knobs, which are the individual enzymes, can't actually function as a catalyst unless they get deformed first. And they don't get deformed unless and until this whole thing spins, because spinning one by one deforms each catalytic knob. So only if the rotor, the blue part, is spinning will any ATP get produced. Now keep in mind, producing this ATP is endergonic. So that's never going to happen for free, right? You have to put in energy to make that happen. But what is the energy source? It is the gradient. That's the final payoff of the proton gradient that was established by operation of the electron transport chains. We have a tendency, because of that gradient, for protons to diffuse back into the mitochondrial matrix. You know, just like if you put in energy by carrying buckets of water uphill, you know, that doesn't happen for free. You have to work on that. If you do that, though, you establish a gravitational gradient for the water. And if you then pour the water onto a water wheel, it will make it spin and it can grind your corn or whatever. That's how mills used to work. The gradient is accomplishing some work for you. Here you have the same thing, but it's the diffusion of protons through ATP synthase molecules, because this is the only place in the membrane where these protons can get back through into the matrix. And when they do go through, that's what spins the rotor, just like water falling on a water wheel. So the payoff of the gradient is that it spins the rotors, deforms the catalytic knobs, and allows the phosphorylation of ADP to create ATP. That's oxidative phosphorylation. And of course, there's some heat lost that's wasted as well, like in all the steps. But there is a lot of ATP produced this way, a lot more than what was produced in glycolysis and the citric acid cycle, the only other two places where we made ATP. So in terms of percentage, 90% of the ATP that you can get out of one glucose molecule comes from this last part, which is why cellular respiration is so valuable. And for a cell, not all cells can do it, but if a cell is capable of cellular respiration, it's going to want to do that rather than just being satisfied with the two ATPs it produced in glycolysis and just waste that pyruvate. That pyruvate is still valuable stuff. Well, this proves that it's valuable, because by continuing to oxidize that remaining fuel and then using all the energy from all those hydrogens that get picked off, you can end up making a lot more ATP via oxidative phosphorylation. Let's look at 19 now. Here we have an electron transport chain again, but now we can see it embedded in the membrane. And it's easier to see now that these three of the four overall complexes that are the big ones, 1, 3, and 4, are operating as pumps. They will stop pumping unless there's electrons being transferred from one member to the next. So the pumps are doing two things. They're members of the chain, so they're receiving and then passing on electrons. But they're also functioning as pumps because when they pass the electrons off, that releases a little bit of the electron's energy. That powers the pump. And notice the directionality. The protons get pumped from the matrix through the intermitochondrial membrane to the intermembrane space. That's where they're accumulated. That's where they're in high concentration comparatively. So that's where the energy is that hasn't been put into ATP form yet. It's in the form of that gradient. That gives the protons the tendency to come back into the matrix, but the only places that they're able to do that are through the copies, the millions of copies of ATP synthase that are embedded in that same membrane. And when they do that, they spin the rotor, and that phosphorylates ADP into ATP. That's the final payoff. Well, 20 is really just an overall summary now that we've been through the whole process. And this looks very similar to a slide we started out with when I first introduced the overall process. But now we know the details, and let's review this. The overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose. There are other fuels, but glucose is the most important fuel. And part one of that overall process is this 10-step pathway called glycolysis, or the glycolytic pathway. That takes one 6-carbon glucose and splits it in stepwise into two 3-carbon pyruvates. So you've done part of the dismantling of the carbon skeleton, and you've picked off some of the hydrogens as well. Because in addition to pyruvate, which is still valuable fuel, glycolysis produces some ATP via substrate-level phosphorylation, and it also reduces some NAD+ into NADH. The NADH is temporarily storing the energy because it's not yet in its final form. We want it to be in ATP form. Well, it's carrying energy as a taxi. And notice where it's carrying it to. It's going to drop it off to the electron transport chains. The pyruvate, which is the output, fuel-wise, of glycolysis, then gets transported into the mitochondrion from the cytosol where glycolysis occurs. That's because the next part after pyruvate is cellular respiration itself. Part two of the overall process, but that occurs in the mitochondrion, so you have to get that pyruvate into the mitochondrion. And in the process of bringing the pyruvate into the mitochondrion, it gets oxidatively decarboxylated. The decarboxylation part of that step means that a carbon and two oxygens get removed from the pyruvate. We talked about this before. And so it's not shown here, but that's one of the 6 carbon dioxides two, because remember, it's happening for each of the two pyruvates that gets produced in glycolysis. So the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate gets you two of the CO2s. Those are totally spent fuel. But what you have left as fuel are two carbon acetyls. And in this process of decarboxylation, some more NAD plus gets reduced into NADH. That's also valuable stuff. Also driving to the same destination, the electron transport chains eventually. Okay. A coenzyme A, another taxi, picks up the 2-carbon acetyl. So there's two taxis involved because each one picks up an acetyl. And that's why it's two acetyl coenzyme A's here, separately driving. But each one drops its acetyl, which is a 2-carbon fuel, onto the citric acid cycle. The citric acid cycle then completes the dismantling of the carbon skeleton and the dehydrogenation of the fuel. That's why at the By the time you're at the citric acid stack, you have no more fuel left. That's where the other four carbon dioxides come from. The other four that are part of the six carbons that were in glucose originally. And in the process, you produce some more ATP. This is also by substrate level phosphorylation. And you produce some more, you reduce more NAD plus into NADH, plus you reduce some FAD into FADH2. Now you have all of these full taxis carrying a lot of energy, and they're all driving, even though they came from different parts, they're all driving to the same destination, which are the electron transport chains that make up the first part of part three of cellular respiration. The first part of oxidative phosphorylation, which is part three, is electron transport. That's where the electrons get dropped off by the coenzymes. And then they get passed along the chains. That releases energy. And that release of energy is what allows those three complexes in each chain to function as pumps, to pump protons from the matrix through the inner mitochondrial membrane to the intermembrane space, creating the gradient. All right, that's electron transport. And then finally, chemiosmosis is the diffusion of protons or hydrogen ions back into the matrix through the ATP synthase molecules that are embedded in that membrane, which turns the rotor and causes phosphorylation of ADP into a lot more ATP. Look at the numbers. Make just a little bit here and a little bit here by a substrate level phosphorylation. Most of the ATP that gets produced is by oxidative phosphorylation. That's the entire process. Is anything about that unclear at the moment? Okay. Let's then go on to 21. Actually, before I talk about 21, let's just think about what I told you about oxygen. What does oxygen do for you?
It takes on the electrons.
Right. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor in electron transport. So oxygen is not part of the chain. The last member of the chain complex 4 is the last member of the chain. But it has to be able to dump its electrons off to something else. That something else is oxygen. Okay, well, if you don't have oxygen available, let me start over. Oxygen is not necessary for glycolysis, the first part of the process. But imagine what would happen if you don't have any oxygen. If you don't have any oxygen, it's not taking electrons off of the end of the chains. So every chain would fill up eventually, right? Meaning no more pumping of protons, meaning no more proton gradient, and there's no more chemiosmosis to produce ATP that way. But it's worse than that. Because if you have all your chains full of electrons, they can't receive any more from the taxis. And therefore, eventually, all of the available taxis would be in reduced form. NADH for the NAD versions, and FADH2 for the FAD versions. The entire two fleets of taxis would be out of service because they are already carrying passengers and they have nowhere to dump them off. Well, the reason that glycolysis works is because NAD plus, an empty taxi, is available to come along and take the hydrogens. So if you have only full taxis, even glycolysis, which doesn't directly rely on oxygen, would shut down. Do you see what I'm saying here? You have to have oxidized, empty taxis available to keep the fuel being burned, being dehydrogenated. And if you don't have any empty taxis, it would all shut down. Well, Without oxygen, cellular respiration is definitely going to shut down. There's no way around that. It would back everything up, even to glycolysis. And if there weren't some other way to get around this problem, then that would be fatal to all cells. But if there's a separate way to run glycolysis, then at least you could make two ATPs to just barely stay alive. Two ATP per glucose is what I'm talking about. You could continue glycolysis, in other words, even if cellular respiration shuts down, but only if there is a way to get empty taxis. Because think about what's happening if you do have oxygen. If you do have oxygen, then everything is running, and you have empty taxis because they're continuously dropping off their passengers. So they don't remain full. So if cellular respiration is working, that has the side effect of continuously producing empty taxis, which can drive back to glycolysis and allow it to continue. You following this? Because when they dump them off the electron transport chain, they become empty again. They're available taxis. Okay, well, they're going to fill up if there's no oxygen. But if there's another way to get the passengers out of the taxis, then even though cellular respiration is shut down, you can still continue glycolysis. And that other way of emptying the taxis is exactly what's shown in slide 21. And there's many versions of it. We're seeing two versions here. But overall, the process is called... fermentation. Now, I said that there are many processes. Any given organism conducts just one version of fermentation. It just depends on what the species is. So you don't, it's, when I say there's many versions available, it's not many versions available to one species. But in nature, there are many ways that this is accomplished, this fermentation. There's a reason that there are only two shown here is because there are two that we particularly care about. And that's because one of these two versions is the version that we do as humans, as animals in general. So we care about that. And that is called lactic acid fermentation. That's the one in the bottom. The reason we care about the other, which is called alcohol fermentation, is because it's so valuable to us industrially as a process. In cheese making, beer, wine, booze, bread, a bunch of different things use this species that do alcohol fermentation. But there's plenty of other versions available. Regardless of what version is used, though, fermentation always accomplishes the same thing, which is the emptying of an NAD taxi. In other words, with more accurate chemical language, what fermentation accomplishes is the reoxidation of NADH, back into NAD plus, right? Taking the passengers off of NADH and H plus and turning it back into NAD plus. That's reoxidation. So this is the alternative. If you have cellular respiration running, you don't need this because dumping the electrons off to the chains does the same thing. It gets you NAD plus again, which can drive back to a glycolysis and allow it to continue. Okay, here's what happens. Now, importantly, fermentation by itself doesn't really produce any ATP. It's glycolysis that's producing the ATP, as usual. But by coupling glycolysis with fermentation, it allows fermentation to continue because the fermentation part is what empties the taxi again. So up here we have glucose, as we've already studied. That produces two pyruvates, each of which has three carbons in it. In alcohol fermentation, which is what yeast do, for instance, they will convert the three-carbon pyruvate into a two-carbon acetaldehyde by decarboxylating the pyruvate. That's what That's why yeast, in their version of fermentation, produce CO2. And then the acetaldehyde gets transformed into ethanol, which is the alcohol part. It's the same alcohol that's in all alcoholic beverages. Well, that's the step that's important as far as fermentation and what it's trying to accomplish is concerned, because that will require an NADH, a full taxi, to deliver its passengers to produce the ethanol, but not because the yeast really wants to make ethanol. It's just doing that so that it can get an empty taxi again, an NAD+, which can then allow glycolysis to continue. So you can keep making the two ATPs per glucose this way and stay alive. Does that make sense? This is also, by the way, when you use this process for humans' benefit to produce booze, produce beer, for instance. This is why beer is not only alcoholic, it's also carbonated, because the CO2 comes off of the pyruvate. Well, our method of fermentation is a little bit different. If we did this same thing, we could just hold our breath, not breathe oxygen, and create alcohol in our blood. We don't do that, though. It's really a more direct process that we use, because we take the pyruvate and we don't decarboxylate it. We don't produce any CO2 in the process. We directly transform pyruvate into lactate or lactic acid. And that accomplishes the same thing. It reoxidizes NADH back into NAD+, allowing glycolysis to continue. But this lactic acid, if it builds up, is part of the reason why you fatigue. You know, if you jog, assuming you have enough fuel in your body, or if you're eating while you're jogging, you can jog pretty much indefinitely, because your breathing and your blood pumping can keep up with the oxygen demand of your muscles when they're not working all that hard. You're continuing to give them enough oxygen for them to make ATP via cellular respiration, and therefore this fermentation is not happening, and therefore lactic acid doesn't build up. But if you sprint or do something as strenuous as possible, obviously there's a limit to that, right? You can't indefinitely sprint. Your body is going to force you to shut down. And that's because you're working your muscles so hard that there's no way your heart and lungs can keep up with the oxygen demand to supply the ATP via cellular respiration. And therefore, cellular respiration shuts down and fermentation has to take over, and the lactic acid builds up, and that acidifies your blood. It's part of fatiguing. It's why your body will just shut down. It won't let you continue to sprint. By the way, you might have heard of the oxygen debt. When you sprint or do something very strenuous, you know, if you stop sprinting, you can't just sit down and be calm like you were before, right? You're going to be huffing and puffing for a while, even though you're no longer running. And that's because it's going to take a bunch of processing to get rid of all that lactate that built up. And that requires a lot of ATP being produced by aerobic means, by cellular respiration, until you get it cleared. Okay, so in 22, we can see the overall process as a fork in the road. Glycolysis has to happen in all situations. Otherwise, death. All right? Here we're assuming that this is a cell that's capable of cellular respiration. Not all are, but like our cells are, for instance. So, at the end of glycolysis, you have pyruvate, as we've talked about. That's the fork in the road, though. If oxygen is available, then it's definitely a benefit to go down this road at the fork, to go to cellular respiration, because that's going to make you a hell of a lot more ATP for that same fuel that you're spending. It's a much more efficient use of the fuel if you go through aerobic respiration. And by the way, what makes respiration is the pumping of protons using electron transport. even textbooks get this wrong, so let me explain that aerobic respiration is, first of all, it's respiration because of that, what I just said. It's the pumping of protons using an electron transport. What makes it aerobic respiration, though, is that the final electron acceptor is oxygen. And it is for a lot of different species, not just us. Okay, aerobic means involving oxygen. Well, not every species, though, uses oxygen as its final electron acceptor. Oxygen does a really good job because of its high electronegativity, but not all species use it for that reason. You can accomplish the same thing. You can still have respiration occurring, which is the operation of the electron transport chains, if you have some other thing besides oxygen to take the electrons. And some species do that. Well, they are still respiring. They're still undergoing respiration. But it's anaerobic respiration because they're not using oxygen for the final electron acceptor. Okay? The reason I'm pointing this out is because fermentation, which is the other road at the fork, is not anaerobic respiration. It's not respiration at all. It's an anaerobic process because it doesn't use oxygen. But it is not anaerobic respiration. So if you read that, even in a textbook, it's wrong. Okay? It's an anaerobic process, though, which is why it will happen if there is no O2 present. It's the only way that you can keep glycolysis happening, since you can't dump the, you can't empty the taxis onto the chains. You have to empty them by making ethanol in some species, lactic acid in some species, and other things in still other species. All right. 23. The three boxes at the top of this slide are the three major nutrient categories. Proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. You find these on food labels, right? Well, they're macromolecules. At least some carbohydrates are macromolecules, right? What we have for the rest of the slide is the overall process that we've talked about for this whole chapter, which is the central pathway, it's often called, meaning glycolysis plus cellular respiration. That's the central pathway. And it's called central pathway because even though we have studied it in terms of using glucose, which is what often happens since glucose is the master fuel, you don't have to be using glucose as a fuel. And other fuels can be fed into this central pathway at different points along the way. So if you have carbohydrate as a nutrient, well, if it's a polysaccharide, which is a big carbohydrate, then you can't use that as fuel. You have to use small molecules as fuel. So the first part would be that you would have to digest the polysaccharide before it's even in your body into monosaccharides, which then get absorbed into the body. Some of those are glucose. Those can go through like we've already talked about. But other sugars, other monosaccharides, can be put into, they can skip a few steps, basically. They can be made into one of the intermediates that we looked at in glycolysis, but that I told you didn't have to memorize. Right, so they just go into a later part of the overall pathway. That's pretty straightforward. The rest of it runs as usual. If you have fats, which are what you're burning, if you've, it's been a while since you've eaten, because you can only store so much glycogen, which is storage polysaccharide. If you haven't eaten, you'll use up all your glycogen, and then eventually you're going to have to start burning fat, which you stored from a previous meal. Well, remember what a fat is. It's a triglyceride or triacylglycerol. So it has a glycerol and three fatty acids. You can break those apart, dismantle the fat. So you have glycerol. Well, that can feed into one of the parts of glycolysis and be used as fuel itself. And you have fatty acids, which are really like acetyls hooked together. Because remember, an acetyl is two carbons and it's hydrogens. A fatty acid is many carbons and its hydrogens. So if you take a fatty acid and just cleave off two carbons and its hydrogens at a time, You're just supplying acetyls. And the cell doesn't know whether those came from glycolysis or from fat. It works the same way. Protein is a little bit more complex. And proteins, we don't usually use primarily as a fuel source. Proteins that we eat get dismantled into amino acids and then assembled differently, according to our gene instructions, into our own proteins that are there for various reasons. They're the enzymes, the structural proteins, all the things that proteins do in the body. They're not really usually used as burnt as fuel. But they can be. You know, if you're starving, for instance, that's going to be eventually the only choice your body has. It uses all the glycogen, burns all the fat, then it has to start breaking down muscles and other proteins to keep you alive. That's when you're wasting away. Well, proteins, if they're going to be used as fuels, have a problem because unlike these other ones, they have nitrogen in them. And so the amino acids, every amino acid, remember, amino means nitrogen, has nitrogen in it. So you digest the proteins into amino acids, and then the amino acids, before they can be used as fuel, need to be deaminated, removed of their nitrogen in the form of ammonia. And that ammonia is toxic if it builds up, which is why your liver, for instance, will convert that ammonia into something that's still toxic, but not as toxic, called urea. And that's a component of your urine eventually. This is why if you eat too much protein, you're going to be producing a lot of urea, and that can lead to gout, for instance. Anyway, that NH3 just needs to be gotten rid of so that all you have left are carbons, oxygens, and hydrogens in the amino acids. And those can feed in at various places along the central pathway, depending on the amino acid. So you can use all three of these for fuels, but glucose is the master fuel. And in your own body, by the way, your brain needs a continuous stream of glucose, which is why it's so important. Because except for ketone bodies, which you can use under emergency situations like starving, the brain can use only glucose as fuel. Can't use fats and these other things that the rest of the body can. And that's why you have mechanisms in your body to transform, if necessary, these other kinds of fuels into glucose just so that the brain can stay alive. This is why insulin and glucagon, two opposite acting hormones, are so important in the body. They keep the blood level of glucose correct so that your brain and therefore you can remain alive. Were you going to ask a question?
Yeah, is that like the whole point of a keto diet?
Yeah, but it's really, well, it's controversial as to whether it actually has any benefits or detriments. But it's really kind of mimics a starvation situation since you're not giving the body the other things that it would need. And that allows your brain to remain alive because it can use ketone bodies. And actually it does pretty well on ketone bodies. It's just not a normal situation. The normal situation is to use glucose for the brain. Uh, 24 must be the last slide. And let me just say that I have like 1 minute left. Let me just say that what's happening here, this is the central pathway again, is control via feedback. Notice you have green arrows, that's stimulation. So the point is here that the central pathway is not always run at full bore. That would be wasteful. It's you run this process only as much as you need to supply the ATP demand that your body has, which depends on what your body's doing. Well, notice that if you have AMP in abundance, what that means is that you've used a bunch of ATP and then you've used the ADP that you've turned it into, and AMP is like a zero balance on the debit card. So you don't normally have a lot of it. If it starts to increase, that tells your body, well, you're not making enough ATP. So that stimulates this whole pathway and makes a lot more ATP to correct the error. But there's various other things that inhibit it, which means if these build up, that tells the body, well, you're running this a little too high than you need to. So it will feed back and inhibit an enzyme in the process, shutting it down, just like we talked about in that feedback inhibition slide. So it's just basic feedback to keep things running the rate they should be running. And that is the chapter.